About a year and a half ago, I was doing a long self-retreat. And then right in the middle of it, I had a few sittings with certain aspects of the teachings from different traditions all fell into place. It was like just those kinds of sittings where we see something from a new angle. And a lot of different pieces all fit together in terms of understanding what it is that liberates the mind, what frees the mind. And it began with my remembering what is called the Buddhist Song of Enlightenment. That is the words that are said to have come to him just after his awakening under the Bodhi tree. You're probably familiar with the famous quotation, "O house builder, you have now been seen. You will build no house again." That is the house of self, the house of ego. Those are the first two lines. O house builder, you have now been seen. You will build no house again. Then he ends the verse by saying, "Realized is the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving." So that's a very clear and unambiguous statement of what constitutes freedom. Achieved is the unconditioned, realized is the unconditioned, achieved is the end of craving. Of course, when we hear this, we might feel a little daunted or unready for such a radical departure from our normal way of life. Can we even imagine a mind that is free of craving, free of desire? We might resonate more easily with that famous prayer of St. Augustine, "Dear Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." But somehow in the immediacy of the meditation and my practice during that retreat, I understood the Buddha's words in a new way. So rather than understanding the end of craving only as some far-off, almost unimaginable goal, or as some meditative state, you know, that I would have to hold on to, I also understood it at that time, achieved is the end of craving. I understood it more deeply as our practice now. That's what we're practicing now in each moment. There was a very famous Tibetan Dzogchen master, Thukul Urgyen, who died some years ago. And he taught about recognizing the nature of mind, the free, open, empty nature of awareness. That is the mind free of clinging. And the way he phrased the teaching, he said, experience it for short moments many times. And I think that's a very good framework for understanding our own practice of the achieving of non-craving. Not as some far-off goal, but to actually experience it for short moments, many times. When we explore this, and this very essential aspect of the Buddha's declaration, the nature of freedom in our own experience, even if it's for short moments, we can recognize for ourselves, see for ourselves, how the force of craving obscures the natural awareness. It obscures the openness of mind. And how in those moments, when we are free of desire, free of clinging, free of grasping, and we do have such moments, we have many moments during the day, although they often go unnoticed, if we recognize those moments free of desire, free of craving, we actually get a certain taste of freedom. We get a taste of peace. So there's a simple experiment you can make. If by some chance a desire should arise, when it does, investigate its nature. Really, when a desire is there, when the wanting mind is there, investigate, look to see, what does it feel like to want? What does desire feel like? And then notice, especially when the desire comes to an end, because it will. It's there, 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 and then at a certain point, it's not there. What does it feel like when the mind is filled with desire? And what does it feel like in the moment that the desire goes away? My experience has been that it is always a sense of relief. It's like being let out of the grip of something. You know, the desire has been gripping the mind, and then as the desire ends, right, that sense of ease. So tonight I'd like to explore in some depth the nature of craving. You know, when the Buddha said, achieved is the end of craving, as a declaration of liberation, of awakening. What is craving? You know, it's a powerful force. It's a force that keeps the whole wheel of samsara, of conditioned existence, rolling along. The Buddha said, that's the source of this whole round of samsara, of life and death. It's the force of craving, the force of wanting. So we need to understand it. It's not something insignificant. So explore the nature of craving, how it manifests in our lives, and some of the different skillful means that different traditions use to come to the end of craving. So craving is the translation in English of the Pali word tanha. And tanha is described as, or means, thirst. Or sometimes elaborated as the fever of unsatisfied longing. You know, so just kind of sit with that for a moment. You know, and just feel in yourself the quality of thirsting for something. You know, or that unsatisfied longing for something. These expressions can give us almost a visceral sense of the compelling power of tanha, of craving. It's the very opposite of peace. Now, sometimes in English we use the word craving and desire synonymously. And when we do, it can be confusing unless we're careful about defining how we're using it. Because in English, we use the word desire in different ways. Sometimes the mind state of desire is craving. You know, we say the desire for something, it's a craving, it's rooted in greed, leading to clinging and grasping. But sometimes we use desire in a completely different way. Sometimes we use that word simply to mean motivation. I have a motivation to do something. I have a desire to do something, to accomplish something. A desire for awakening. That's very different than craving or grasping. Right? It's the quality of motivation, motivation to do. But in the context of tonight's talk, I'm going to be using these two words synonymously. So understand it in that way. For tonight's talk, when I use the word desire, I'm meaning craving. So you understand it clearly. The Buddha taught in the second noble truth of the Four Noble Truths that craving is the underlying cause, the underlying source of suffering. And he pointed out three areas in our lives and in our minds where this craving manifests. So the first and most obvious kind, the one we're most familiar with, is the craving or desire for sense pleasures. You know, and that includes the sixth sense of the mind. And we're all familiar with this. We can see this desire for sense pleasures play out in our lives in varying degrees of intensity, in varying degrees of frequency. You know, sometimes it's really obsessive desires, obsessive cravings that consume our lives. You know, it could be addictive cravings for so many things, for food, for alcohol, for sex, for drugs, for success, you know, for fame, for wealth. We all have different conditioning, and these desires can become very strong. And our culture keeps feeding them. It fosters, actually, and nourishes this craving. How much email spam have you gotten that said, increase your desire? As if that's a good idea. Or I saw one magazine advertisement. It said, instant gratification just got faster. Shop Vogue.com. So it's like our culture is just feeding this particular energy in the mind of wanting, of desire, of craving, as if it's a good thing. Or the desires, maybe they're not addictive cravings, which, you know, can happen in our lives. But we can see desire play out just in passing thoughts of wanting. You know, that take us out of the natural open ease of mind. And a very common example of this is what I call catalog consciousness. I don't know whether you get quite as many catalogs in Canada as you do in the States, but our mailboxes are filled. And if you make the mistake of just opening it, what happens, I've seen this in myself and I think it resonates with many people, keep turning the pages looking for something to want. No, I don't, nothing on that page, nothing on that page. Maybe on the next page I'll want something. And so we've been conditioned to want, you know, and this is nothing more than the force of craving or desire in the mind. Sometimes we can experience how deeply rooted this force is, even in the smallest of desires. Many times, both on retreat and off retreat, but it's very noticeable on retreat, I'll be sitting and walking, and then the thought will come, oh, a cup of tea. And I'll note it, and it'll go away. 15 seconds later, oh, a cup of tea. I'll note it, it'll go away. Oh, a cup of tea. And this may go on for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Oh, a cup of tea. And then I get it. It's amazing how some little desire, it feels like it has a root to the center of the earth. It's very persistent. Now, often these different patterns of desire and craving are just so ordinary and so familiar to us that they go unnoticed. You know, we don't even pay attention to them in our lives. We just take them to be who we are. And that's why it's so important to see the value of bringing awareness and mindfulness to these different aspects of desire and craving, so we can begin to understand how they're playing out and to free ourselves. The retreat environment is very conducive to really watching for desire arising in the mind, because there aren't that many opportunities to gratify. Here we might experience craving just as the indulging enjoyment of fantasies. You know, you're sitting, nobody's bothering you, nice and quiet, and the mind can get lost in pleasant fantasies. Maybe it's about, you know, some great new project you want to do, and the mind just gets lost in it and it's enjoyable. Or maybe it's some really enticing sexual fantasies that are really enjoyable. You know, or maybe, contrary to what happens with aversion, with desire, not the Vipassana vendetta, but the Vipassana romance. You know, somebody here you're just attracted to, you know, and you just like everything about them. You don't even know them. But the mind can play out a whole fantasy of meeting them and sitting next to them and talking to them after the retreat and getting married and we can get caught in these fantasies again and again, even when we know they don't lead anywhere. They're not going anyplace, usually. A very helpful technique, if you find yourself noticing, you know, the mind caught by these desires, caught by these cravings, something, it's a note that I've used in my practice. As soon as the desire, as soon as the fantasy starts, I put up a little sign in my mind, dead end. Because having gone down them 10,000 times, realizing that they don't go anyplace, so kind of spend all that time in them, and just coming back and again reconnecting. So it's better to have the dead end sign at the beginning rather than at the end. It's a reminder. We can also experience desire or craving not only as kind of these pleasant fantasies, but it can come in the form of expectation or desire for some new experience, for something else to be happening, you know, for some great meditative opening. Now, if you've noticed how this works, you will see that expectation inevitably brings agitation to the mind. It's not helpful. It locks us into cycles of hope and fear. Hope that what we want will happen, fear that it won't happen. It does not make for a peaceful mind. But the expecting mind is very seductive because it also comes disguised. It comes disguised very often as aspiration. We think, oh yes, I have this aspiration for some new or great experience. But expectation and aspiration are really two very different mind states. For example, we could practice the very beautiful aspiration of bodhicitta, that aspiration that we awaken for the benefit of all beings, that our practice, that our lives be for the benefit of all beings. So that's a wonderful and noble aspiration. That's very different than expectation. Right? In that aspiration, we're not grabbing. And we actually see, and we're not trying to hold on to. Rather, the aspiration is fulfilled by a letting go into the wisdom mind of awareness. Very different than the expecting, wanting mind. Expectation also feeds the comparing mind. It's what I call competitive sitting. You know, have you experienced at all some kind of comparison with other yogis? You know, as if somehow meditation is a race to some finish line. There's a difference between being inspired by other people's practice, which can often happen, or getting caught up in the comparing mind, you know, and getting caught in self-judgment about one's own, or pride about one's own relative to another's practice. This happened to me really strongly the very first retreat I sat with Sayadaw Upandita. When he came in 1984 to Barrie, it was a three-month retreat, very intense. We were seeing him every day for an interview, sleeping just 4 hours. It was a really intense retreat, and I was going through a very difficult time. And I saw all these other yogis, you know, who seemed to me to just be getting more and more enlightened. And I could watch my mind go through these, you know, comparing and then self-judging and then projecting and all of that. And then one day I walked outside, I was doing walking outside, and it was springtime, and the flowers were coming up. You know, and it was just in the early spring. And the tulips were coming up, and I saw that some of the tulips had come and already bloomed. Some of the tulips had come up, but the flower hadn't opened. Some of the tulips were just pushing up through the earth. And suddenly my mind just released, you know, from all of that comparing. I realized, the tulips don't compare. Oh, I'm ahead of you. Each one came in its own time, and all it just needed is, you know, you water it and you have the sun, and good earth, and the flower will happen. When these desires, all the comparing, the expecting, the wanting, when they go unnoticed, they hinder concentration, they hinder clear awareness, and they play out in our lives as well. Now, something to reflect on with respect to desire and craving is that, rather ironically, even though we invest so much in them, they don't deliver on their promise of happiness. You know, we keep investing in them because we think they will make us happy. We believe that experiencing more and more sense pleasures will bring us happiness because of the pleasant feelings that come with them. And they do, for a time. The problem is that the pleasant feelings, as we know, are very impermanent. And so they're continually disappearing. And then we go after another one, and another one, and another one. It's like trying to quench one's thirst by drinking salt water. You know, it just makes us thirstier. How many sense pleasures in our lives have we already experienced? Countless. Have you come to a sense of fulfillment, completion? Probably not, or you wouldn't be here. And I wouldn't be here. So we've already had countless moments of the happiness of sense pleasure, the fleeting happiness. So we know, this is not theoretical, we know someplace deep in ourselves, we know, yes, there's a momentary happiness, but they're not going to provide what we're really looking for. It doesn't mean that we don't enjoy the pleasures of the senses when they come. It's just to reinforce that deep, genuine, authentic understanding that these kinds of sense pleasures and the happiness that comes from them are very transitory. The nature of that happiness is very impermanent. So how much of our lives and our energies do we want to invest in this endless pursuit? Many of you might be familiar with the great novel by Tolstoy, Anna Karenina. Of course, it's a brilliant novel, and it's a lot about the nature of desire and craving. And you know, for those of you who haven't read it or not read it recently, you know, Anna's married to this Russian bureaucrat, falls in love with a handsome guards officer. They fall in love together. He gives up his career. She runs off, you know, and they have this great affair. And then things change. So this is just a few lines from the novel. The guards officer was named Vronsky. And he had been passionately in love, you know, with Anna. So Vronsky, meanwhile, in spite of the complete realization of what he had so long desired, was not perfectly happy. He soon felt that the realization of his desires gave him no more than a grain of sand out of the mountain of happiness he had expected. It showed him the mistake men make in picturing to themselves happiness as the realization of their desires. You know, and it's just so universal. You know, we think happiness will come from the fulfillment of our desires. But actually, Dharma practice and a deepening understanding of the Dharma opens us to the possibility of a much greater kind of happiness. You know, much deeper peace in our lives. So this is the arena of the first kind of craving. It's the desire for sense pleasures. The second kind of craving goes even deeper. The second kind of craving the Buddha talked about is the basic urge or desire to be. It's the craving for becoming, the craving for continued existence. So this gets more primal. Right? This is not just some little sense pleasure we're after. This is the desire for continued or renewed existence, particularly in pleasant realms. You know, we may or may not believe in rebirth and the heavenly planes of existence, although they are part of the Buddhist teaching. But we can see this kind of craving for becoming just right here, leaving aside the future lives. How does the craving for becoming play itself out right here in this life? We can see it when we're lost in the planning mind, imagining ourselves in some future state, some future situation. Notice how often, just in the course of a day, in the sittings, notice how often we get lost in the mind creation of a future self. I'll do this. I'll go there. I'll accomplish this. I have this project to do. It's like we create a self, a model of ourselves, a clone of ourselves in the future. Now, the Buddha gave some very specific and challenging instructions to us. So really listen to this. Again, a reminder, don't listen to it as philosophy. Take it as a practice. It's an instruction to do. Well, the Buddha said, not reviving the past. That would be a good one. Not reviving the past, not hoping to be in the future. Instead, with insight, see each arising state. Not craving after past experience, not setting one's heart on future ones, not bound up with desire and craving. Even just for a moment, could you imagine or drop into the mind right now, not reviving the past, not longing for the future, not setting one's heart on some future experience, not bound up with desire and craving? It's like the heart opens into ease, into emptiness, into selflessness. So this is our practice. Maybe short moments, many times, but we can taste it. On a momentary level in our practice, we can see this craving for becoming in the unfolding process itself. How often in our lives, but very specifically in our meditation practice, are we leaning into the next moment? As if somehow the next moment of experience will bring completion, will bring fulfillment. The next breath, the next sensation will resolve everything, will complete everything. It's so odd because we've had so many breaths already. So why do we think, okay, I'll just, the next one. So I call this mind, I call it the in order to mind. We're watching or being with something in order for something to happen. We see it a lot when we're being or pretending to be mindful of some unpleasant experience, but we're really watching it in order for it to go away. You know, or maybe we're with some emotion and we're watching it in order for it to open more fully, in order for us to feel it more fully. You know, always leaning into the next moment in order to. Then we don't see that all experiences are simply empty appearances arising and passing in the mind, in the moment. They're arising and passing, forming and dissolving like clouds in the sky. There's nothing to get. And when we let go of this craving for becoming, that leaning forward, that's when we drop back into the peace of the moment. The sense of being pulled forward into each next moment is this craving for becoming. We forget that liberation is not about getting. It's not about holding on. It's not about craving. It's not about clinging. It's not about having some new experience. This is from a teaching by Dilgo Khenpo Rinpoche. He said, if we have interesting experiences, either during or after meditation, we should avoid making anything special of them. To spend time thinking about experiences is simply a distraction. These experiences are simply signs of practice and should be regarded as transient events. We should not attempt to re-experience them, because to do so only serves to distort the natural spontaneity of mind. All phenomena are completely new and fresh, absolutely unique and entirely free from all concepts of past, present, and future. They are experienced in timelessness. We see the possibility when we're not caught by that craving for becoming, that leaning forward. We're not trying to recreate experiences. We're not holding on. We don't give any special importance to special experiences. We're just fresh with each new moment's arising. What's amazing is how simple it is. But somehow we don't trust the simplicity. Ramana Maharshi expressed it very succinctly. He said, try to be less, not more. So that's just a good mantra to carry through life. Try to be less, not more. Okay, so there's the craving for sense pleasures. There's the craving for becoming. The last kind of craving the Buddha talked about, said it's the craving for non-existence. Life in this moment is so bad. If only I could not be. You know, it's like wanting to end experience. years ago, and many, many years ago, in my practice, going through the dukkha stages. You know, there's just a lot of suffering and difficulty in the practice, and Michelle McDonald and I were going through the same kind of phase, and we formed what we called the Dukkha Club. We would just kind of commiserate with each other about one's dukkha. And we had a kind of a theme poem. It was by a Latin American poet, or Central American, I'm not sure, his name was Dardio. And the first line of this poem was, "Oh, to be a stone with no feeling at all." So that's the nature of this craving for non-being, craving for non-existence. I mean, another point, actually, was in that retreat with Upandita in 84 that was so difficult. At one point I was sitting, remember this in 84 was still the Cold War, you know, so I heard planes flying overhead and things were so hard. I thought to myself, "Ah, I hope the Russian planes are going to drop some bombs so I can stop sitting." It wasn't very compassionate for my fellow yogis, but like anything to get out of here. That's that third kind of craving. But the craving for non-existence, just like the other kinds, is fed and sustained by a view of self. It's really an ego trip. You know, and so in the three kinds of craving, there's either a self to gratify, or a self to clone in the future, or a self to get rid of. You know, so all three kinds of craving are rooted in this idea of self. But as that writer and somewhat enlightened being, Wei Wu Wei, wrote, whoever thinks that a self exists objectively is like a dog barking up a tree that isn't there. So we live our whole lives barking up this tree of self that isn't there in the first place. So the great discovery in practice is that on one level, you know, birth and death, existence and non-existence, self and other, are the great defining themes of our lives. You know, on one level, that's how it is. But on another level, and as our Dharma practice deepens, we begin to appreciate this, we see that all of life is just a dance of changing, empty appearances. It's like it's a magic show of consciousness. So the question for us, as it was for the Buddha, how can we experience the mind that is free of craving, free of grasping? How do we come to this place of freedom? And here we can see how different traditions all converge in their understanding of what frees the mind. And even though within Buddhism, you know, there are many, many traditions, there are lots of methods and vocabularies and metaphysics, in all of them there is one essential taste of freedom. There was in Tibet this great master, I think it was 19th century or early 20th century, this vagabond monk named Patril Rinpoche. And he would just wander around the countryside in rags, and he was this vagabond. He was renowned for being, you know, this great realized being. And the local people loved him because he was just kind of this ordinary seeming guy. He was very enlightened. So he summed up the essential point of freeing the mind. In some lines of a poem he wrote, and the name of the poem is Advice from Me to Myself. Okay, so this is Pachol's advice to himself. Listen up, old bad karma Pachol, you dweller in distraction. For ages now, you've been beguiled, entranced, and fooled by appearances. Are you aware of that? Are you? Right this very instant, when you're under the spell of mistaken perception, you've got to watch out. Don't let yourself get carried away by this fake and empty life. Your mind is spinning around, carrying out a lot of useless projects. It's a waste. Give it up. Thinking about the 100 plans you want to accomplish with never enough time to finish them just weighs down your mind. You're completely distracted by all these projects which never come to an end, but keep spreading out more like ripples in water. Don't be a fool. For once, just sit tight. You beat your little Tibetan drum, and your audience thinks it's charming to hear. You're reciting words about offering up your body, but you still haven't stopped holding it dear. You're making your little cymbals go ting, ting, without keeping the ultimate purpose in mind. All this Dharma practice equipment that seems so attractive, forget about it. If you let go of everything, 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 that's the real point. Even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. That's what I really want to say. I love that first line. Listen up, old bad karma Pachol. I feel like it resonates. Okay, so how do we let go of everything? You know, the message is clear. Just let go of everything, everything, everything. That's really what I want to say. But how do we do it? You know, the patterns of craving, the patterns of clinging are so strong. So in traditional Vipassana practice, we decondition the force of craving, letting go of everything, through an increasingly refined experience of impermanence. And we really pay attention to the momentary nature, to the arising and passing of phenomena, moment after moment, until we see so clearly there's nothing to hold on to, and at times things are happening so quickly we can't hold on. You know, we're just in the flow, we're in the river of changing phenomena. Whatever arises also passes away. And it's happening very, very quickly. So this is a little article, part of an article from The Inquiring Mind, the last year, by Wes Nisker. He wrote, in the subatomic world, time is sometimes measured in what scientists have named attoseconds, which is a millionth of a trillionth of a second. It takes an electron about one attosecond to travel all the way around a proton. Meanwhile, inside the proton, perhaps one level deeper into reality, an attosecond would be regarded a long nap. Down here, within the proton, time is measured in zeptoseconds, a billionth of a trillionth of a second. I think at some point the physicists realized that they had entered a Marx Brothers routine, where the jokes are coming so fast you begin to see that it's all a joke. So when they started measuring things changing even faster, in trillionths of a second, they named it a yoctosecond. Atto, zepto, and yocto. By the time it takes a particle to circle around inside a proton, proton is somewhere between a zeptosecond and a yoctosecond, all you can do is smile and let go. Things are changing really quickly. But we may not be perceiving things quite at that level. But there can also be powerful moments of letting go through seeing impermanence on more conventional levels. Now, I don't know out here in the Northwest, but in New England, in the woods, very common, throughout the woods, throughout the forests, you come upon miles and miles of old stone walls, you know, where the farmers had cleared the fields, built these walls, but now it's second, third growth forest. And you see foundations, stone foundations of old houses, and all that's left of the stone foundations, you know, or the very old headstones in the cemeteries. And you think of all of those life stories, you know, of the people who built those walls and lived in those houses, and, you know, hundreds of years ago, all those life stories as vivid and as compelling as our own. You know, and where are they now? And what remains? And there's a teaching on impermanence, which sometimes I'm actually reluctant to share because it's so powerful. It's something that Deepa Ma, you know, said to one of her students. And for those of you who don't know, Deepa Ma was one of our teachers in India, and she was this amazing, amazing woman. I mean, she had a very hard life. She was married when she was 14, which was common in those days. She had a very good marriage, waited a long time to have kids, which was a source of great suffering, because she really wanted children. And then she had three children, you know, in a row, two of whom died very young, and then her husband died. And she said that she was just completely stricken by grief, that she was bedridden for 5 years because of the grief, and she thought she was going to die from it. You know, so overwhelming, the suddenness, you know, of the loss and the grief. Somebody suggested, she was living in Burma at the time, that she go to a monastery and to practice some meditation. And she did, and it was just this extraordinary. She had these amazing paramis, just maybe from past lives or someplace, but very quickly she attained very high stages of realization within a couple of weeks, and attained all the levels of concentration, the jhana practice, all the psychic powers. She was this amazing, amazing woman, and totally filled with metta. I mean, she just embodied peace and love. You know, and when you went to see her, we knew her when she was back in Calcutta, you know, and she would just bless you by running her hands over your head and shoulders. It was just like a shower of bliss, you know, just incredibly loving. This is what she said. This is in the book, Deepa Ma, which is actually in the store here, which is about her life. So this was a little passage from one of her students that's quoted in the book. When my son died in 1984, Deepa Ma shocked me with her words. It was a hard teaching I have not forgotten. So she's quoting Deepa Ma. Today your son has gone from this life. Why are you shocked? Everything is impermanent. Your life is impermanent, your husband is impermanent, your son is impermanent, your money is impermanent, your building is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. There is nothing that is permanent. When you are alive, you might think, this is my daughter, this is my husband, this is my property, this car belongs to me. But when you are dead, nothing is yours. Sudipti, which was the woman's name, you think you are a serious meditator, but you must really learn that everything is impermanent. That's pretty powerful. You know, when her son had died, and that's the teaching. But this was coming from Deepa Ma, who had lived through this. This was not just philosophy. the power of that. Do we really get, do we really know? Everything is impermanent. You know, we get so attached to people, you know, to family, to things, to the world, to... Sudipti, you think you are a serious meditator, but you must really learn that everything is impermanent. So we need to take this in on this very profound level. You know, meditation is not a hobby. It really isn't. It's about opening to absolutely the deepest aspects of what is true. And it's only on that level that the mind is freed. On all of these levels, the more we allow the truth of impermanence to permeate our lives, not only conceptually and not superficially, when we really know it and see it and feel it and experience it, the more we're able to let go, to not hold on, to not cling. This is from the abbess of a Zen monastery. It's from a book called Women of the Way, 2,500 Years of Buddhist Wisdom. And the name of the book is by Sally Tisdale, and it's a story of Taijitsu, who was the abbess of this nunnery. And she's describing in the book, describing the awakening of Taijitsu. She saw that phenomena arose, abided, and fell away. She saw that knowing this arose, abided, and fell away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind, and let go, and fell into the midst of everything. You know, it's such a beautiful description. Opening the clenched fist of our minds and falling into the midst of everything. So in Tibetan Dzogchen practice and some Zen practices, Zen tradition, we can experience and touch the mind that's free of craving, not only through this deep realization of impermanence and letting go, but through the direct recognition of the empty, aware nature of the mind itself. So we really look at the nature of mind. We recognize the empty nature of mind and experience not craving in that way. This is from Zigar Kongchul Rinpoche. The experience of emptiness is not found outside the world of ordinary appearances, as many people mistakenly assume. In truth, we experience emptiness when the mind is free of grasping at appearances. Again, it's the same message. We experience emptiness when the mind is free of grasping at appearances. But sometimes there are subtle fixations of mind that are difficult to see. You know, we might be aware of all the objects of experience arising and passing away. But there can be a subtle fixation or a subtle identification with awareness itself. And this becomes a very interesting place of investigation, seeing how awareness itself can be reified in some way. It's as if we make a home of awareness, and then a sense of self settles right into that home. So this is very subtle. You know, here we are talking a lot about resting in awareness and But we need to take care that we're not becoming identified even with awareness, because that's just another fixation of self. That's another kind of holding or craving. And it's very interesting to explore this. Trungpa Rinpoche, he said, the failure to recognize the mind's true nature occurs because its empty aspect is obscured by its lucid or knowing aspect. So this, now I'm just playing a little bit because it just is fascinating to me. Kind of if we're exploring the nature of the mind from the Tibetan point of view, it's the union of emptiness and clarity. The union of emptiness and knowing. Right? But it's very difficult to really recognize the true nature of mind, because the knowing aspect, as subtle as it is much more apparent than the empty aspect. Right? And so that's how we get identified with the knowing, the awareness, and we're not really understanding the mind's true nature. So how can we cut through this identification? You know, this very subtle identification even with knowing. In the different traditions, there are different ways. In Vipassana, I'm going to go on fast forward a little bit because we're coming to the end of the time. In Vipassana, we can cut through the identification with knowing when we're seeing the very rapid arising and passing away. And at different stages, we see the arising and passing away of consciousness itself. You know, and so that really weakens our identification with it. Andy Olensky, who's the director of the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies and is a Buddhist scholar, he had this, in one article he wrote, consciousness is not a thing that exists, but an event that occurs. And I thought, oh, that really captures it. It's not a thing that exists to be identified with. It's just an event that occurs out of conditions. Okay, the last way I want to talk about how we can cut through identification even with awareness. It's talked about in both Tibetan and Zen tradition, where the instruction is to look for the mind. Look for the mind. Can you see it? Can you taste it? Can you touch it? When you look for it, look for the mind. When you look for it, you see that there's nothing to find. Now, this is the key point. And the not finding is the finding. That experience of not finding, when you look for the mind, there's nothing to find. Right in that moment of not finding is the experience of its empty nature. So sometimes the liberating power of this not finding, look for it, nothing to find. Sometimes this is realized quickly. And sometimes after we've practiced for a long time. So there's one famous Zen exchange. The result of this exchange is that the person asking the question got enlightened. Here's your chance. Okay, I'm not sure how the name is pronounced because it's a Chinese name, H-U-I-K-E. So I pronounce it Huike. So he was somebody who came to see Bodhidharma, you know, who was the great enlightened being who brought Buddhism from India to China. So Huike was suffering a lot. Comes to Bodhidharma, who's been sitting in his cave for 7 years. Huike says, please teach me the Dharma seal of all the Buddhas. Bodhidharma. The Dharma seal of all the Buddhas cannot be obtained from someone else. Hueka. My mind is distressed. Please pacify it with your teaching. That could be us. Our minds are distressed. Please pacify it. Bodhidharma. Present me your mind, and I will pacify it. Hueka. Now really listen to this, because I've searched for my mind, but I can't find it. Bodhidharma. There, I've pacified it. We can experience that. Look for the mind. I can't find it. It's already pacified. That is the mind free of craving, free of wanting, free of clinging. Achieved is the end of craving. Maybe for just a moment, but we can taste that. So we practice in all of these different ways. And the Buddhist Song of Enlightenment can inspire our own journey. Realized is the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving. Let's sit for just a moment.